She looks down at the file. You are also very, very angry. Incredibly angry. She looks at me. You are also very intelligent. I take a sip of my coffee. Sounds about right. Does it? Except for the intelligence part. Why do you say that? If I was very intelligent, I probably wouldn't be so fucked up. Addicts, as a group, generally score far above average on intelligence tests. Why? You tell me. I guess maybe we're smart enough to have figured out how shitty things are and we decide addiction is the only way to deal with it. You acknowledge that you're an addict. I laugh again. Yeah. I wasn't sure you would. I do. Good. That's the first step toward getting better. If it's one of the 12, then it's the only one I'm taking. You're getting angry. Yeah. Why? Right now I'm getting angry thinking about the impossibility of ever getting better. Is that all you're angry about? No. What else? Pretty much fucking everything. She laughs. Everything? I smile. Sounds stupid, but it's true. I'm angry about pretty much everything. How long have you felt that way? Forever. As a child? My first memories are of anger and pain. That's too bad. It's the way things are. I think if we can work toward finding the source of your anger, we'll be a long ways toward solving a number of your issues. The only way to get to your anger is to control your addictions. And the only way I truly believe you'll be able to control your addictions is by working the 12 steps. Not happening. She takes a deep breath, leans back. I light another cigarette. Do you know the success rate of this hospital? No. It's about 17%. That's of patients who are sober for a year after they leave here. That sucks. That's the best success rate of any treatment center in the world. That really sucks. I've worked in 6. I'm an alcoholic and an addict myself, and the only thing I've ever seen that works is the 12 steps. You don't seem like an alcoholic or an addict. Everyone that works here is. Even the janitors and the dishwashers. That way, if you need help, everywhere you turn, there are people who can help you. That's comforting. It is supposed to be. How long have you been sober? 16 years. Long time. You can have that, too. You just have to do what we tell you and trust us, even if you think it's ridiculous. If it involves the number 12, it's not gonna happen. It's the only way, James. The only way. I'm going to be honest with you about something. I would appreciate that. I walked out of here 2 nights ago. Where were you going? I was going to go find some shit and kill myself. Why didn't you? You know Leonard? I know of him. Leonard stopped me. That surprises me. Why? That's a separate issue. What? We'll talk about it some other time. There might not be another time. You're serious? Yeah. Do you really want to die? I know I can't keep living the way I've been living, and I know I won't ever believe in the 12 steps. People like you keep saying it's the only way, so I'm thinking I might as well just put myself out of my misery now and save myself and my family the pain of the future. Do you really want to die? I fucking hate myself. I'm sick of it. Why are you still here? I promised Leonard I'd stay for 24 hours. Then my brother and a couple of old friends showed up for visiting hours. I ended up having a good day, the best day I can really remember having for a long time. And when the 24 hours were up, I was too tired and too happy to think about killing myself. You can have more days like that. Not if I can't stay sober. You can stay sober. Not if your way is the only way. It is. And you can do it. I shake my head. Nope. She leans back in her chair and she lights another cigarette and she stares at me. I stare back. She speaks. You have two decisions to make, James. The first is whether you want to live, and I believe you do. I believe that deep inside of you, you realize what a horrible waste it would be to kill yourself. I believe that what you present to the world and what you are on the inside are two different things, and that you know that what you are on the inside is something that's worth saving. The second decision is whether you're willing to do what it takes, and what we tell you it takes, to get sober. You need to decide whether you're going to stop being stubborn, and whether you're willing to open your mind to something that you really don't know anything about. Take your time and think. As we both know, you are a very intelligent young man. If you have any questions, come see me. If you decide the answer to your decisions is yes, come see me. If your answers are no, I'm sorry, and good luck to you. She stares at me. I stare back. I have a question. What? Why didn't you guys throw me out of here after I attacked Roy? She takes a drag. Lincoln and Ken wanted to throw you out. I hadn't met you, but I'm good friends with Hank. When Hank heard what had happened, he came to me and he told me that the person who attacked Roy was not the person he knew. He said the person he knew was kind and gentle and quiet and shy and was the strongest and bravest person he'd ever seen. I trust Hank, and I fought to keep you here because he told me I should. I like Hank. He likes you. You're friends? We hunt and fish together, play cards. He's sort of my boyfriend. I laugh. Tell him I said hi, and that I'm taking good care of his coat. He'll be glad to hear it. We done? I hope not. I stand. We'll see. She stands, hands me a card. That has my home phone number on it. If I'm not here and you need me, call. What if you're at Hank's house? He sleeps at my house. I laugh. Thanks. I walk to the door, and I walk out, and I close the door behind me. Lectures. Group therapy. Smile at Lily in the dining hall. Ken pulls me into his office. Have you thought about what we talked about last time you were here? I don't remember what that was. Are you ready to do anything and everything it takes to get sober and stay sober? Yeah, I thought about it. Do you have an answer? No. Do you have an answer? No. Do you have an answer? Staring at me and asking the same goddamn question over and over isn't going to get us anywhere. He stares. Do you have an answer? I laugh. No. Hopefully at some point you will. We'll see. He sighs and shakes his head, looks at the papers on his desk. I want to start getting into the meat of your program. All right. He pulls out what looks like a children's coloring book and he hands it to me. We'll start with this. I look at the book. What's this? It's a first step workbook. I laugh. It's a fucking coloring book. It's simple, yes, but we think the simplest approach is the best. When's my deadline? 2 days. Got it. There's also a goal board hanging on the upper level. I want you to put your name on it and put down a life goal that you have and hope to achieve through sobriety. Okay. You have any ideas? New set of teeth every year? Not funny. Become president of the United States. You'll be lucky to vote with your record. Make mine the prettiest first step coloring book ever? You through? You tired of me? Put down a goal. Don't make a joke out of it. I'll do my best. I also think a change of scenery might be good for you, so this afternoon I'm going to switch your room assignment. To where? To a two-man room. Warren and John are leaving later today, and I think it would be better to fill that room with newer arrivals. I'd like that. I'll make the switch and tell you the room number later.
Cool.
You seem better, and you seem to be making headway, but you need to take what we're doing in here a bit more seriously.
I'll try.
Come and find me when you finish the book. I'd like to go over it with you.
Okay.
I stand and I leave. I walk back to the unit, get my coat, and walk outside into the frozen woods. How am I here? How have I arrived in this place, at this moment, on this day, with this feeling, history, future, problems, life, this horrible, fucked-up, good-for-nothing waste of a life? How? I ate my lunch with some kind of menacing, middle-aged movie star look-alike. I was given a coloring book and told it would help make me better. I am not getting better. I am 23 years old, and I've been an alcoholic for a decade, and a drug addict and criminal for almost as long, and I'm wanted in 3 states, and I'm in a hospital in the middle of Minnesota, and I want to drink, and I want to do some drugs, and I can't control myself. I'm 23. I breathe, and I shake, and I can feel it coming, and rage, and need, and confusion, regret, horror, shame, and hatred fuse into a perfect fury. A great, and beautiful, and terrible, and perfect fury. The fury, and I can't stop the fury, or control the fury. I can only let the fury come, 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 come. Let it motherfucking come. The fury has come. I see a tree and I go after it. Screaming, punching, kicking, clawing, tearing, ripping, dragging, pulling, wrecking, punching, screaming, punching, screaming, punching, screaming. It is a small tree, a small pine tree, small enough that I can destroy it, and I rip the branches from its trunk, and I tear them to pieces. One by one, I rip them, and I tear them, and I throw them to the ground, and I stomp them, stomp them, stomp them, and when there are no more branches, I hear a voice, and I attack the trunk, and it's thin, and I break it in half, and I hear a voice, and I ignore it, and I throw the broken trunk on top of the branches, and one half of it is still in the ground. I hear a voice, and I want it out of the fucking ground, and I grab it and pull, and it doesn't budge, not an inch. I hear a voice, and I ignore, and I pull, scream, pull, and it doesn't budge. This fucking tree, I want to destroy it, and I let go of it, and there is a voice. Ignore. I start kicking, 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 and the voice says, stop, 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 stop. Stop. I turn around. Long black hair and deep, clean blue eyes and skin, pale white and lips, blood red, she's small and thin and worn and damaged. She is standing there. What are you doing here?
I was taking a walk and I saw you and I followed you.
What do you want?
I want you to stop.
I breathe hard, stare hard, tense and coiled. There is still more tree for me to destroy. I want that fucking tree.
She smiles and she steps toward me. Toward me, and she opens her arms, and I'm breathing hard, staring hard, tense and coiled. She puts her arms around me with one hand on the back of my head, and she pulls me into her arms and she holds me and she speaks.
It's okay.
I breathe hard, close my eyes, let myself be held.
It's okay.
Her voice calms me, and her arms warm me, and her smell lightens me, and I can feel her heartbeat, and my heart slows, and I stop shaking, and the fury melts into her safety, and she holds me, and she says, okay, okay, okay. Something else comes, and it makes me feel weak and scared and fragile, and I don't want to be hurt. And this feeling is the feeling I have when I know I can be hurt, and hurt deeper and more terribly than anything physical, and I always fight it and control it and stop it. But her voice calms me, and her arms warm me, and her smell lightens me, and I can feel her heartbeat. And if she let me go right now, I would fall, and the need and confusion and fear and regret and horror and shame and weakness and fragility are exposed to the soft strength of her open arms and her simple word, okay, and I start to cry. I start to cry. I start to cry. It comes in waves, The waves roll deep, and from deep, the deep within me, and I hold her, and she holds me tighter, and I let her, and I let it, and I let this, and I have not felt this way, this vulnerability, or allowed myself to feel this way, this vulnerability, since I was 10 years old, and I don't know why I haven't, and I don't know why I am now, and I only know that I am, and that it is scary, terrifying, frightening, worse, and better than anything I've ever felt, crying in her arms, just crying in her arms, just crying. She guides me to the ground, but she doesn't let me go. The gates are open, and 13 years of addiction, violence, hell, and their accompaniments are manifesting themselves in dense tears and heavy sobs, and a shortness of breath, and a profound sense of loss. The loss inhabits, fills, and overwhelms me. It is the loss of a childhood, of being a teenager, of normalcy, of happiness, of love, of trust, of reason, of God, of family, of friends, of future, of potential, of dignity, of humanity, of sanity, of myself, of everything, everything, everything. I lost everything, and I am lost, reduced to a mass of mourning, sadness, grief, anguish, and heartache. I am lost. I have lost everything. Everything. It's wet, and Lily cradles me like a broken child. My face and her shoulder and her shirt and her hair are wet with my tears. I slow down, and I start to breathe slowly and deeply, and her hair smells clean, and I open my eyes because I want to see it, and it is all that I can see. It is jet black, almost blue, and radiant with moisture. I want to touch it, and I reach with one of my hands, and I run my hand from the crown along her neck and her back to the base of her rib, and it is a thin, perfect sheer, and I let it slowly drop from the tips of my fingers, and when it is gone, I miss it. I do it again and again, and she lets me do it, and she doesn't speak. She just cradles me because I am broken. I am broken. Broken. There is noise and voices, and Lily pulls me in tighter and tighter, and I pull her in tighter and tighter, and I can feel her heart beating, and I know she can feel my heart beating, and they are speaking, our hearts are speaking a language wordless, old, unknowable, and true, and we're pulling and holding, and the noise is closer, and the voice is louder, and Lily whispers, "You're okay. You're okay. You're okay." And she lets me go. And I let her go, and she stands, and I stay, and she stares down at me. I have to go. I stare at her. "I'll call you later." I stare at her. "Bye." I stare at her, and she backs away toward the far edge of our clearing. When she reaches the edge, she turns around and she disappears through evergreen thick, and I hear her step settling, and her step is gentle. And I hear voice intermingle, and her voice is gentle, and I sit, and I breathe, and I sit, and I stare. I am alone, lost and broken. I stare at the evergreen thick, alone, lost, broken. The sun is falling, and the cold is running, and the night is descending, and I'm tired, spent, completely empty. I force myself to stand, and I make my way through the trees until I pick up a trail, and then I let the trail lead me. My feet are heavy, my body is tired, and my heart is beating slow, slow, slow. The walk is only a couple hundred yards, but it seems across the earth. It takes all my strength to open the door. I step inside, and I walk through the unit, and I go to my room. As I enter, I see that all of my things, my new, beautiful things, have been stacked on a chair near my bed. I flare momentarily until I notice a letter sitting on top of my clothes. I reach for it, and I open it, and I read it, and it is from Ken, and it says, "Per our earlier conversation, you are being moved to a new room, and it has the room number." I pick up my clothes and my books, and they are my only belongings in the world, and I leave. I walk through the hall surrounding the unit looking for my new room. I find the room, and the door is closed, and my arms are full, so I kick the door open with one of my feet. I walk inside. The room is smaller than the other room, but otherwise identical. There are two beds and a bathroom off to one side. There is a middle-aged black man lying on one of the beds. I have never seen him before. He looks at me and he speaks.
Most people knock before entering a room.
He has a deep, slow southern accent. I didn't know anyone was here. I walk to the empty bed.
You could have knocked anyway.
I sit down.
Sorry.
I start putting my stuff away.
Are you living here?
Yeah.
What's your name?
James.
Hello, James. My name's Miles.
Like Miles Davis?
Exactly like Miles Davis.
Exactly?
Yes.
Your name is Miles Davis?
Yes, it is.
I laugh. You play the trumpet?
No, I play the clarinet.
He motions toward a black case sitting at the foot of his bed.
I played the trumpet when I was younger, but when the other Miles got famous, I quit. It was a bit too much.
Where are you from?
New Orleans. Where are you from?
I live in North Carolina.
Which part?
Wilmington.
Do you like Wilmington?
It's nice, but I don't really give a shit. He laughs.
What do you do down in New Orleans?
I'm a judge.
What do you judge? I'm a judge in the Federal Circuit Court of Appeals.
That's heavy. He shrugs.
It is what it is.
You put people away?
I did when I worked in the criminal court, but I don't anymore.
What was that like?
It's hard putting away a man. There's nothing good waiting for him in jail, even if he does deserve it.
I nod.
What do you do?
I get in trouble. He laughs.
What kind of trouble?
All kinds.
You in trouble now?
Wouldn't be here if I wasn't. He laughs again.
Are you in any other trouble?
Can I plead the fifth?
If you would like.
I would. He looks at his watch.
Have you eaten supper yet?
No.
Would you like to eat with me?
I stand.
Let's go.
He stands and we leave the room. We walk through the halls to the cafeteria and we get in line and we get some food. When we sit down at a table, I find out that Miles is an alcoholic and that he's married and he has 2 children and he arrived here this afternoon. He speaks quietly and methodically and he chooses his words carefully. And he says as much with his hands and his eyes and the motions of his head as he does with the words themselves. When I speak, he listens carefully, softly interjecting with a nod or a chuckle or a quiet word of validation. He is immediately a friend, which is strange to me. I have always hated cops and judges, or authority figures of any kind, and the last place I would have ever thought I would befriend one would be in a treatment center. After a few minutes, we are joined by Leonard and Maddie and Ed and Ted. It is a typical meal with them. They laugh, make fun of one another, tell stories about their pasts, talk shit about the clinic's other patients. Aside from Miles, there are 4 new men on our unit, and Leonard and Maddie and Ed and Ted size them up, talk about which ones they like and which ones they don't like, and make plans to fuck with them. There is one, a short, fat man named Bobby, whom they seem to harbor a particular dislike for, though I don't know why. I do know that I'm glad I'm not him. We finish eating and we walk as a group to the lecture. We sit as a group in the seats. I sit on the aisle and I watch for Lily. When she walks in, my heart jumps and my hands shake, and me myself inside settles. It settles, and those things for which there are no words ignite and they start firing. Firing, firing. When the lecture's over, we stand and we start to file out, and before I leave, I turn to get a glimpse of Lily, but I can't see her, and I don't want to make my intentions obvious, so I turn back and I keep walking. I wish I could see her. I want to see her. I don't see her. I walk back to the unit and I go to my room and I lie down on my bed. Miles walks in, and he sits down on his bed, and he reaches for his clarinet case, and he starts unpacking it, and he asks if I mind if he plays, and I say no, play whatever you want for as long as you want, and I reach for a book, one of the books my brother gave me, and I don't bother looking to see what I'm reaching for because I don't care. I just want to read, and I want to occupy my mind with something. The rage and need are back. They have returned, are alive as they almost always are, living and lingering and eating me away. I need something to occupy my mind. I don't care what it is. Occupy. I pull the Chinese book, the Tao Te Ching, by far the smallest of the three that I have, and the only one that I haven't read before. It is a small, thin paperback. The title is written across the front in simple white type against a black background. I flip the book over and I look at the back, and there are quotes on the back from three sources that I have never heard of before, but that look like bullshit New Age hippie periodicals. There is a publication classification in an upper corner. It reads religion. I am immediately skeptical. Not only because of the source quotes and the religion classification, but because I've always grouped books such as this in a category with crap like astrology, aromatherapy, crystallology, pyramid power, psychic healing, and feng shui, which at various times in my life have all been suggested as cures for my problems. That anyone would actually believe that these things could solve their problems, really solve them, instead of just making them forget about them for a while, is asinine to me. My brother gave me this book, though, so I'll read it. Had anyone aside from my brother given it to me, it would be sitting in the bottom of a garbage can. As I open it, Miles starts playing his clarinet. He plays softly and slowly. The notes are on the low side, and he draws them out to the point that I wonder how he's breathing. The notes are on the long side, and he makes them sound like they are easy to make, though I know they are not. Low and slow and soft and long and easy. I don't know what it is, but I like it. I skip the introduction. If the book goes in the trash, I want it to go because of my thoughts on it, not because of some asshole's thoughts who wrote the introduction. The text begins. It consists of a series of short poems, numbered 1 through 81. The first one says that the Tao is that which has no name and is beyond any sort of name. It says that names are not necessary for that which is real and for that which is eternal. It says that if we are free from desire, we can realize mystery, that if we are caught in desire, we only realize manifestations. It says mystery and manifestations arise from the same source, which is darkness. It says darkness within darkness is the key to all understanding. It is not enough to make me throw it away, but I am also not convinced. I keep going. I keep going as I listen to low and slow and soft and long and easy. I keep going as I settle in beneath the warmth of my bed, and I keep going as I wait for the phone to ring. When the phone rings, I know I will get to hear the sound of Lily's voice. I want to hear the sound of Lily's voice. Number 2. If there is beauty, there is ugliness. If there is good, there is bad. Being and non-being, and difficult and easy, and high and low, and long and short, and before and after, need, depend, create, and define each other. Those who live with the Tao act without doing, and teach without saying. They let things come, and they let things go, and they live without possession, and they live without expectation. They do not need, depend, create, or define. They do not see beauty or ugliness or good or bad. There just is. Just be. Number 3. Overesteem men and people become powerless. Overvalue possessions and people begin to steal. Empty your mind and fill your core. Weaken your ambition and toughen your resolve. Lose everything you know and everything you desire and ignore those who say they know. Practice not wanting, desiring, judging, doing, fighting, knowing. Practice just being. Everything will fall into place. 4. The Tao is used, but never used up. An eternal void, it is filled with infinite possibilities. It is not there, but always there. It is older and more powerful than any god. It is not there, but always there. It is older and more powerful than any god. I stop reading and I read them again, 1 through 4, again and again. The words and the words together and the meaning and the context are simple and basic, so basic and true, and that is all that matters, true. They speak to me, make sense to me, reverberate within me, calm, ease, sedate, relax, still, pacify me. They ring true, and that is all that matters, the truth. Although I am no expert on this or anything related to this or anything at all except being a fuck-up, I seem to understand what this book, this weird, beautiful, enlightened little book, is saying to me. Live and let live. Do not judge. Take life as it comes and deal with it. Everything will be okay. I close the book and I let the sounds of the clarinet carry me, carry me, carry me. They are low and slow and soft and long and easy, as are the thoughts in my head. They carry me, carry me, carry me. Live and let live. Do not judge. Take it as it comes. Deal with it. Everything will be okay. I've been sitting outside on a bench in the dark when Leonard appears. He motions toward the wood. Let's go for a walk, kid. I stand and we start walking. We find a trail. Leonard finally says, let's find a place to sit down, kid. I got a story to tell you. We walk until we find a bench along one of the smaller lakes. Though I am lightly dressed, I am warm. My heart is beating, and I am surviving, and I am warm. Leonard looks out across the lake. He is calmer than I have ever seen him. The edge of violence, control, and power that he carries is gone. He starts to speak. I told you how my father died, how he got hit by a truck and killed. Before he died, as he lay in a hospital bed, he took my hand and he told me that the only thing he ever wanted for me was that one day I be successful enough to play the golf course he mowed for 15 years just like I was one of the members. I promised him that someday I'd do it. Leonard takes a deep breath. I told you how my mother died and how Michelangelo and Gina adopted me and raised me like I was their own. On top of raising me, Michelangelo guided me into his business. What that isn't important for you to know. What's important is that he taught me to do it and he set me up in it. I took care of details for him and he watched over and protected me. An opportunity came up for Michelangelo and Gina to move to Las Vegas. They took it and I went with them. We did very well, very quickly. As Vegas was growing and booming, so were we. We had money, houses, cars, whatever we wanted. It was all there, everything we ever wanted. Those were the best years of our lives. Leonard stops talking, stares at the ground. He takes a deep breath, looks up. Then Gina got cancer. It was a bad cancer. Cancer of the bones. And it took her quickly and brutally. In 3 fucking months, and she went from being the most beautiful woman in the world to a fucking skeleton. And when it killed her in a certain way, killed both me and Michelangelo, too. He shakes his head, stares across the lake. Nothing was ever the same. Michelangelo lost interest in our business and turned it over to me. I didn't see him much after that. I think we just reminded each other of what we had lost. Those were shitty, depressing years. We both started drinking more and doing too much cocaine, but Michelangelo completely lost it. A day came when I needed to see him, talked to him about something, so I went over to his house. I hadn't been there in months, and when I walked in, I was sick to my stomach. There were mirrors full of coke on tables, bottles and cans everywhere, garbage piles in every room, and blonde girls with big fake tits sleeping on the couches and lounging by the pool. I went up to his room and he was sitting there with a couple of young girls and a bunch of drugs. I told the girls to get out, and I walked him out to the pool, and I sat him down, and I looked him in the eye, and I said, Mikey, you should be fucking ashamed of yourself. You should be ashamed of how you're living, and ashamed that you're desecrating the memory of your wife. Gina would have wanted better for you, and if she's up in heaven watching you, she's probably crying her eyes out. He didn't say a word to me. He just turned around and walked out of the house. I didn't know where he went, didn't hear from him at all, so I started mourning him. My mourning was just like his. I drank too much, did too much coke, and did a lot of stupid bullshit. About a year later, I'm asleep in my bed and I hear someone in my house. I always keep a gun under my pillow, so I reached for it and started walking around. I heard someone in my kitchen, and I walked in, and there was Michelangelo, 50 pounds lighter, looking better and healthier than I'd ever seen him. He looked at me, and he asked why the fridge was so goddamn empty. I gave him a hug, and I asked him where he'd been, and he told me he was here, at this clinic, where you and I are right now. He told me that when he had left his house the day I sat him down, he had planned on driving into the desert and blowing his brains out. But once he got there, he couldn't do it. He decided that if he was going to die, he wanted to die how he'd lived most of his life, which was with dignity and honor. He had heard about this place and decided he was going to come here. He bought a map and drove up here from Vegas and stayed until he felt he was better. Then he got in his car and he drove around for a few months, saw the White House and Key West and Bourbon Street in Alaska. He saw everything he had always wanted to see but never had. He had come home to tell me that he was going to retire and that he wanted me to come here. He said this place changed his life. He said getting sober had been the hardest thing he'd ever done, but next to getting married and spending his life with Gina, it was the best thing he'd ever done. He wanted me to do it. He said he wouldn't ever leave or die until I did. We spent the rest of the day playing golf and talking about this place. He said when he first got here, he thought he had made a big mistake. He thought about leaving, but he didn't. A few days later, he felt better and he knew something was working. A month after that, he knew he was going to be okay. There were still bad times and rough times and times when he didn't think he was going to make it, but when they came, he just held on. He held on tight and with everything he had until the good started coming back. When he was finally ready to go, he said he knew he wasn't ever going to drink or use again. He said he walked out of here happy and proud. For the next few days, we talked more about the effect that this place had on him, and we talked more about me coming here. About a week after that, he came by my house and picked me up and told me he was taking me out to eat at my favorite restaurant. I don't know how he did it without me knowing, but he had set up a big dinner with all of our friends, even some of our old ones from New York. When we walked in, they were all waiting for us. We ate, drank, snorted coke. Michelangelo told me that he was putting me on a plane the next day, so I really went at it. After a couple hours, he told me he was going home. He said he didn't feel entirely right spending an entire evening with so much liquor and so many drugs. He gave me a hug, and he said he'd pick me up at noon to take me to the airport. I hugged him back, and I told him I'd be ready, and I was going to make him proud. He said he already knew. Leonard takes a deep breath. He turned, and he walked away, headed toward the valet. I watched him from the door as he waited for his car, hoping that he'd turn around so that I could wave to him. As he was standing there, a black Lincoln pulled up and the windows went down. I knew what was happening and I tried to yell, but before I could say anything, the barrels came out. They started blazing away. Just blazing the fuck away. Michelangelo went down straight away. And even as he was down, the guns kept fucking blazing. By the time I got there, he was done. Hit 16 times. Twice in the chest, 4 in the stomach. Rest in his arms and legs. People were running all over the place. There was blood everywhere, and he was done. Shot 16 times by a carload of cowardly fucks. Leonard's voice cracks, and tears start running down his cheeks. I held him as he bled. Just held him and told him how much I loved him. He was still conscious, and he could still talk, but he knew he was done. Right before he went, he lifted a bloody hand, and he put it on my cheek. He looked me in the eye and he said, Live honorably and with dignity. Respect the memories of all your parents. I want you to play the course of your first father and play it like one of the members. And I want you to live sober and live free. Do that for me, Leonard. Live sober and live free. It's going to be hard and scary and brutal, but if you just hold on, you'll be okay. Just hold on. And then he died. Right in my arms, shot down like a fucking dog. He died in my arms. Leonard breaks down and starts weeping. It is a strong, shaking, sobbing, racking weeping. The weeping that comes from a wound that will never heal. I let him weep. Leave him be with his memories and his loss and his pain. I would offer him comfort, but it wouldn't matter. The wounds that never heal can only be mourned alone. He regains his composure and with it his edge of violence, control, and power. He stares out across the lake at the burning mist and the floating, cracking ice, but with an image of the dead held firm in his mind. I didn't get on my plane the next day or any day for a long time. I buried Michelangelo next to Gina, and I wept at their graves just like I wept a moment ago, and just like I weep whenever I think of them. Then I spent a week locked in my house getting blitzed beyond comprehension. When I emerged after that week, the only thing on my mind was vengeance. I spent the next year tracking down the motherfuckers responsible for Michelangelo's murder. Then I found the motherfuckers they worked for, and then I found the motherfuckers those motherfuckers worked for. What I did to them does not deserve to be spoken of, but I will tell you that I did not give them the luxury of being held by someone who loved them when I turned their fucking lights out. I spent the year after that drinking and doing blow and trying to get my ass on that goddamn golf course in Westchester. I wasn't able to, so I decided to take a break and come here. The thought being that if I wasn't able to make my first father proud, I would damn well do it for the second. It has been incredibly hard being here and doing this. Much harder than I imagined it would be. When I got here, I was a fucking wreck. Not a wreck like you were, but bad enough. Every second that passed was a miserable hell. Now it's getting easier. But it's still fucking awful, and there are still a lot more bad times than good times, and a lot more bad feelings than good feelings. I don't know what I think about higher powers and 12 steps and all the rest of what they talk about in here, but I do know that when things are tough and when I don't think I can last another minute, if I just hold on tight with everything I got, shit gets better. The old man was right, just like he was always right. And he spoke the truth with his final words. Just hold on. Just hold on. Leonard turns and he stares at me. I stare back. I told you this story for a number of reasons. The most important is that when you get down, or you don't think you can fucking do this anymore, just hold on. And sooner or later, the shit is gonna get better. We stare at each other. As I said before, kid, you walk out of here and I'm having you brought back. As many times as it takes, I will have you brought the fuck back. You can go ahead and test me on that if you want, but I would suggest you not. The smart thing would be to take my advice. I may be a coke addict and a fellow patient and a fuck-up of the first order, but I am giving you good advice. Be smart. Be strong. Be proud. Live honorably and with dignity. And just hold on. We stare at each other. I am listening to him and respecting the words that he is speaking. They are true. They come from a place of experience and feeling. I can believe in those things. Truth, experience, and feeling. I can believe in them. Just hold on. You think you can do that? I nod. Yeah, I can do that. He smiles. You're not gonna fight me on this. I shake my head. No, I'm not gonna fight you. You're getting better, kid. I chuckle. I turn and I look back across the lake. The mist is gone and the ice diminished, the drip of the icicles quick and heavy. The sun is up and the sky is blue, empty, blue, light blue, clear blue. I would drink the sky if I could drink it. drink it and celebrate it and let it fill me and become me. I am getting better. Empty and clear and light and blue. I am getting better. At breakfast, Lily bumps into me near the conveyor belt. She drops her tray and it hits the floor and there's a mess and she bends over to clean it up and I bend over to help her. As I reach for an empty coffee cup, she slides her hand across my hand and I can feel a piece of folded paper within her hand. As she slides it away, the piece of paper stays, just like a drug deal on a street corner. We pick up a plate and an empty cereal bowl and a fork and a knife and a spoon. We put them on her tray, and as she puts her tray on the conveyor, I walk away. I put the piece of paper in the front pocket of my pants, and I go to the lecture hall, and I find a seat in the back row. I am early, and the hall is nearly empty. I reach into my pocket, and I pull out the piece of paper. My hands are shaking. I unfold it. I turn the paper over, and there are words. I can see words. I need to concentrate, focus, be calm enough to read them. Words, I can read them. They say, "Meet me in our clearing at 4. I read them again. "Meet me in our clearing at 4. I read them over and over, and they say the same thing, over and over. "Meet me in our clearing at 4. My hands are shaking. Shaking, and my heart is beating, beating, and my eyes won't focus, and I have to concentrate to make them focus. "Meet me in our clearing at 4. Again and again. Again and again. The lecture starts, and it is about the 5th step of the Almighty 12. It is being given by a Catholic priest. I don't listen to a word of it. I sit and I stare across the lecture hall. I sit and I stare at Lily. The lecture ends. I stand and I follow the rest of the patients out, enveloped in the flood toward the doors, enveloped in the flood of my memories. As I step out and into the hall, Ken is standing, waiting for me, waiting as he always waits. It seems as if he's always standing there waiting for me. "James? What's up, Ken?" "Checking to see if you've completed the 1st step workbook." "I have not." "I'd like you to spend the morning working on it." "Okay." "Take your time. But if you finish, bring it by my office. If I'm not there, just leave it on my desk."
"Will do."
"Any progress on the goal board?"
"No."
"Put a little thought into that as well."
"Okay.
I'll see you later."
"Looking forward to it."
Ken chuckles and he walks away. I turn in the opposite direction and I walk to the unit. I go to the lower level and I get a box of Crayolas and I check for Razzle Dazzle Rose. It's there, as are 63 other beautiful crayons. As I start back up the stairs, I see the goal board hanging on a wall in the upper level. I walk over to it and I stand in front of it and I stare at it. It is a large piece of laminated poster board divided into boxes using vertical and horizontal lines. In each of the boxes is a name, written in erasable marker, and next to the name is a goal. Some of the goals are simple. Things such as find a job and keep it, stay sober for 60 days, be a functioning part of society. Some of the goals are sad. Things like get my wife to talk to me, regain the respect of my children, stay out of jail for 6 months. Most of the goals are things like improve my relationship with my friend and savior, the Lord Jesus Christ, work the program right and live the steps in every moment, get myself in shape, be buff in mind, be buff in spirit, be buff in body. The goal next to Maddie's name reads stop fucking swearing, which makes me laugh. The goal next to Leonard's name reads, hold on, which makes me smile. The goal next to Miles' name reads, live, which makes the most sense. The space next to my name remains empty. In the face of surviving long enough to survive in the long term, there is no goal that comes to mind that means anything to me. I could write survive, but I would rather hold that word in my heart than write it on some fucking board.
When I have laughed at all here, which has been too infrequent an occasion, it has always felt good. I could write laugh on the board, but I would rather write something that makes me laugh every time I see it. So I pick up a marker, and next to my name I write, I'm going to L.A. to make all of my dreams come true. I'm going to be a Laker girl. When I am finished, I laugh. When I step back and I read my words again, I laugh. As I walk from the upper level and I enter the hall which leads to my room, I laugh. Laughing feels good. I haven't laughed enough, and I want to laugh more. I'm going to L.A. to become a motherfucking Laker girl. I walk into my room, and I sit down on my bed, and I open the box of Crayolas, and I open the workbook, and I pull the Razzle Dazzle Rose from the box, and I start reading. The first part of the book tells the story of Joe. Joe is a drunk who loses his wife, his job, all of his money, and ends up in the street drinking cheap wine straight from the bottle. All the while, Joe refuses to admit that he has a problem, or that he has lost control. The story is told in simple words and in simple pictures consisting of empty outlines of figures and places, the inside of the outlines being the part that needs coloring. The idea, I am guessing, is that while spending time filling in the pictures, I am supposed to grasp the horror of Joe's story and then relate that horror to situations in my own life. If Joe is out of control, I must be out of control as well. If Joe ended up on the street, I better be careful, or I will end up in the street with him. In the back of the book, after the conclusion of Joe's story, which has a happy ending when he admits that he has lost all control and he joins AA, is a 27-question survey about the pattern of an individual's drinking. The questions are simple, and all of them require yes or no answers. Did you ever wake up on the morning after drinking and discover that you could not remember part of the evening before? Yes. Are there certain situations when you feel uncomfortable if alcohol is unavailable? Yes. When you are sober, do you regret things you have done while you were drinking? Yes. Do you have the shakes in the morning after drinking? Yes. Do you sometimes stay drunk for several days at a time? Yes. Yes, 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 yes. I answer yes to every question, all 27 of them, which, according to the key at the end of the survey, means that I'm in the late stages of chronic and dangerous alcoholism. Tell me something I don't fucking know. I put the Razzle Dazzle Rose crayon back in the box and I pull out the black crayon. Unlike most of the other crayons, black has hardly been used. People probably avoid black because it isn't considered a happy color. And in here, any form of happiness, even something as base as the color of a crayon, is coveted. I, however, like black. It is a color that makes me comfortable, and the color with which I have the most experience. In the darkest darkness, all is black. In the deepest hole, all is black. In the terror of my addicted mind, all is black. In the empty periods of my lost memory, all is black. I like black, goddammit, and I am going to give it its due. I flip back the pages of the book until I reach the first page. I pick up the beautiful black crayon and I write I in a large, simple block style, starting at the top of the page and finishing at the bottom, crossing over and ignoring any and all of the outline figures. On the next page, I write, don't. On each of the following pages, I write, need this bullshit to know I'm out of control. When I am finished, I review my work. Each page looks perfect, and I like it. I close the book. Job well done, James. I don't need this bullshit to know I'm out of control. Job well done. I have an hour before lunch, so I toss the coloring book on the floor where it belongs and I pick up the Tao Te Ching. I look at it, front and back, at the stupid quotes and the silly lettering and the funny name. I wonder if I was suffering from an episode of insanity when I last read it. I wonder if I was just tired or vulnerable from my encounter in the clearing with Lily. I wonder if the sound of Miles' clarinet had somehow hypnotized me. I look at the book and I wonder how it affected me the way it did. I read only 4 pages. I open it at number 5 on page 5. I let my eyes run across the words. I let my brain process them. I let my heart feel them. Number 5 is like the rest. There is no good or evil, no sinner or saint. There simply is what is, and that is it. You can use that to be, and that is enough. Don't talk about it or question it. Just let it be. Just be. It still affects me, and it still makes sense. It still moves me, and it still rings true. That is all that matters. The truth. Does it ring true? It does. I can feel it. Number 6. The Tao is the great mother, the great father, the great nothing. It is empty and inexhaustible. It is always present. You can use it or not. Does it ring true? It does. 7. Infinite and eternal. It was never born and will never die. It is just there. It wants nothing and it needs nothing. It is just there. Stay behind and get ahead. Detach and become. Let go of all and you will be full. Let go of all and you will be full. 8 and 9 say the good is like water that nourishes without trying. They say in thinking be simple, in conflict be fair. They say don't compare or compete, simply be yourself. They say fill your bowl to the brim and it will spill. Keep sharpening your knife and it will dull. They say chase after money and your heart will never unclench. Care about what other people think and you will always be their prisoner. These things, these poems, these words, these meanings, they make sense to me. They do not tell me to do anything or be anything or believe in anything or become anything. They don't judge me or try to convince me. There is no righteousness or pretension. They don't fight me or insult me or tell me I'm wrong. There is no authority and there are no rules. They are just words strung together on a page, sitting and waiting patiently for me to accept or reject them. They don't care if I do either or both or nothing at all. They will never tell me I'm wrong. They will never tell me I'm right either. They just sit there. I don't read them again. I close the book and I let them sit. I am on my bed and I like my bed. It is soft and warm and I am not soft or warm, but I imagine that it would be nice to be that way. I have never known it. I know a cold, hard, raging fury deep inside of me and I am tired of it. I am tired of the feeling. I want to die so that I don't have to feel it anymore. I would like to be soft and warm. I would be terrified to be that way. I could be hurt if I were soft and warm. I could be hurt by something other than myself. It is harder to be soft than it is to be hard. I could be hurt by something other than myself. It is nearing noon. I can hear men talking outside my room. They are walking to the dining hall and they are laughing about something. I wonder what they'll feel when the laughing stops. In here, laughing is the only drug. Laughing or love, they are both drugs. I get out of bed and I take my coloring book to Ken's office. It's empty, so I leave the book on his desk. I go to the dining hall and I get a plate of macaroni and beef and I sit down with the same men I eat with at every meal. Matty, Ed, Ted, Leonard, Miles. It's a typical meal. Stories and swearing and a few laughs. Lincoln comes over and asks me to go see Joanne with him. I get up and I walk with Lincoln to Joanne's office. When we get there, he knocks on the door. We hear Joanne's voice. Come in. He opens the door. We step inside. Joanne is sitting behind her desk. She motions for us to sit. Lincoln sits on the couch. I take a chair between the couch and the desk. Joanne speaks. Hi, James. How are you? Fine. You? I'm fine. She holds up my first step workbook. Care to explain this?
I laugh.
I think it's pretty self-explanatory.
Lincoln speaks, an edge of anger in his voice. It's completely unacceptable. That and your goal are an insult to what we're trying to do with you.
I thought that fucking book was an insult to my intelligence.
And my goal is a joke. I put it up there because it makes me laugh, and laughing makes me feel good, and that's my only goal, to feel good. When I feel good, I feel like I'm getting better.
Joanne speaks. I understand your intentions, James, though I'm not sure they're appropriate.
Lincoln speaks.
They aren't.
Joanne speaks.
We try to plan a patient's recovery program and their future after they leave here, as they are working through what we do and what we teach. At this point, you're not as far along as we would like. You seem to have some grasp of the first step.
I laugh.
Why are you laughing?
I speak.
The first step, if I remember correctly, says we admitted we were powerless over alcohol and drugs, that our lives had become unmanageable. I have a fairly sound grasp of that concept.
Lincoln speaks.
You're sure of that?
I'm wanted in 3 states. I'm addicted to alcohol and crack. I'm unemployed, unemployable, and completely broke. I've blacked out every night for as long as I can remember, and my time in here is the longest stretch of sobriety I've known since I was 10 years old. I am out of control. If you want to hear me say it, I'll say it. I am out of fucking control. My life is unmanageable.
Joanne speaks.
We're not the enemy, James.
I know you're not.
Lincoln speaks.
Don't treat us like we are.
Don't treat me like an idiot. Talk to me like I'm a fucking baby and waste my time with coloring books, and I won't treat you like the enemy.
Lincoln shakes his head.
Joanne speaks.
Getting back to the subject, you are not as far along as we would like. You are resistant to everything we tell you. We don't think that you'll be ready to move into a normalized existence once this program is over. If you're not facing jail time, and that is something we would like to start working on by contacting the authorities in the states in which you have issues, we want to put you on a waiting list for a halfway house.
What would I do there?
It would be a lot like this, except you'd be expected to hold a job during the day.
No way.
Lincoln speaks.
Why?
Because that's not going to work for me.
Why?
I'm starting to figure out how I think I can do this. I won't know until I'm in the real world and until I can test myself. That test will not be real to me if I know that I can go running back to the safety of some halfway house.
Joanne speaks.
There is no such thing as safety when you're dealing with a profound and incurable addiction. Halfway houses offer support, and you're going to need all the support you can get. You're going to need it when you leave here a month later, a year after that, and most likely for the rest of your life.
I don't want safety or support. I want there to be me and whatever I have to face, be it alcohol or drugs or something else. I want there to be a fight, because I know how to fight. There will be a winner of that fight. If it's me, I walk away and I have beat the shit that I didn't think I could ever beat, and I move on with my life. If it's not me, at least I get it over with.
Lincoln speaks.
If you don't survive your little test, you're gonna die.
Is that what you want to do? Die?
If I can't stay sober, it is.
You won't stay sober if you keep doing what you're doing.
Why do you think that?
It's not what I think, it's what I know. I know it because every time someone comes in here thinking they have a better way, they walk out of here and they fall and they don't get back up.
You may be right, but at least I'll fail knowing I did the best I could with what I believed in.
Joanne speaks. I don't like this idea of a test. I think it's dangerous, foolish, and stubborn. I think the stakes are too high for you if it doesn't work out. I want you to think about that. To really think about the idea that your resistance to what we're trying to do with you may cause your death. Meet me here tomorrow after morning lecture and you and I will talk about things, and hopefully move forward.
I stand.
Do I need to do anything else this afternoon? Just think. I'll see you tomorrow. I walk to the door and I walk out and I shut the door behind me and I walk back to the unit. I go to my room and I look at the clock next to Miles' bed. It reads 3:42. I am meeting Lily in 18 minutes. I get Hank's jacket. I put it on and I walk through the unit. I open one of the glass doors and I step outside. I walk through the grass, there is no dew, and I find the trail and I enter the wood. There is sun streaming through gaps in the trees like girders of light. I walk along the trail. I see broken branches and I see torn leaves spread like crumbs, and the torn leaves lead me. The signs of my destruction lead me. I push my way through the thick and I step into the clearing. It is empty. I sit down on the dirt and I lie back and I close my eyes. I have not slept enough and I am tired. I need more sleep. I am tired. Tired. I am tired. I feel a hand on my face. It's soft and warm, resting on my cheek, caressing it without moving. Lips follow it on the other cheek, full and wet and soft and gentle. There is sweet breath behind and sweet breath after. They both leave my cheek. I wish they would stay. I open my eyes and I slowly sit up. Lily is next to me, bundled in a large green army jacket, black hair in braided pigtails, her pale skin reflecting a girder of sun. She smiles and she speaks. "Hi. What time is it?" She looks at a cheap plastic Superwoman watch on her wrist. Beneath it I see scars. 4:10. I rub my face. "I fell asleep." She smiles again. "I woke you up." I smile. "I'm glad." She leans forward and she kisses me on the cheek. She holds her lips soft, wet, warm, and gentle. My instinct is to pull away, but I don't. When she pulls away, she leaves sweet breath behind her. "Answer a question for me?"
"Okay."
"Do you have a girlfriend?"
I hesitate, a flash of her, arctic and blonde. "No."
"Why'd you hesitate?"
"I did, but I don't anymore." I thought of her for a second.
"Where is she?"
"I have no idea."
"When was the last time you spoke to her?"
"About a year ago."
"You over her?"
"No." Lily smiles, leans forward, and she kisses my lips.
"That's too bad. You want to smoke?"
She reaches into one of the pockets of her jacket and she pulls out a pack of cigarettes.
"Yeah."
I take one.
"You got a lighter?"
I reach into my pocket, pull out a lighter.
"Yeah."
I flip it, lighter smoke, light mine.
"You having a good day?"
I inhale. I feel the nicotine immediately. It doesn't feel as good as Lily's kiss. "It's been long." She inhales, stares at me.
"They're all long in here."
My instinct is to look away, but I don't.
"Yeah. Tell me something."
"All right."
"Why are you here?"
"Here at this place or here with you?"
"Either one."
"I don't know." She smiles.
"That's a good answer."
My instinct is to look away, but I don't. I speak.
"Why are you here?"
She smiles.
"Here at this place, or here with you?"
I smile.
"Either. I came to this place because of my grandma."
"She brought you in?"
"She convinced me to bring myself in."
"How'd she do that?"
"She loved me and she took care of me even though I was a total disaster. And whenever I did something stupid, which was pretty much every day, she told me that when I was ready to learn about freedom, I should come talk to her. A while back, something really, really awful happened. It fucked me up bad and I went and found her and I asked her what she meant. She told me that I was a prisoner of my mom and of all her problems, and a prisoner of my dad, who I don't remember, and she told me that I was a prisoner of drugs and sex and of myself. She told me that living life as a prisoner was a waste of life, and that freedom, even a second of freedom, was worth more than a lifetime of bondage. She told if I wanted to learn more, to come talk to her again the next day. I did, and she told me the same thing. A second of freedom is worth more than a lifetime of bondage. Then she said, come back again the next day. I did, and she handed me a map, and she said, let's get in the car. You're driving. 8 hours later, that map led me here. She said she had been saving money for 3 years, and if I wanted freedom, I should walk in the front doors and she'd pay for it. So I walked through the door, and here I am. I stare at her. I stare at her eyes, clean water blue, and her hair braided jet black. I stare at her skin, pale white, and her lips blood red. I stare at her body beneath the jacket. She is so small. I stare at her wrists and the Superwoman watch and the scars running vertically. I stare at me, but not me. I see the damage and pain of hard years. I see the emptiness and desperation of existence without hope. I see a young life that has been too long. I see me, but not me. I trust myself. I can trust her. She looks at her watch with her free hand, looks at me. We should go. She stands and she pulls me up with her. We stare at each other for a moment and she puts her free hand on my cheek. She does not let go of my hand with her other hand and I am glad she doesn't. I'll call you tonight. Good. She leans forward and she kisses me. Though it is the same as before, it isn't the same at all. It is more, stronger, weaker, deeper, quieter, louder. It is more vulnerable, impenetrable, fragile, secure, unprotected, completely protected. It is more open, deeper, full, simpler, true. It is more true. She pulls away, her lips pull away. Without words, we walk hand in hand through the thick wood. At the dense edge near the trail, she stops and she guides me forward, and our hands slide slowly apart until there are two fingers, one each of our fingers touching, not wanting to let go or be away. I stop. I let my finger, the tip of my finger, touch hers, the tip of her finger. We stare at each other. Her smile has not gone away, and mine will not either. It will be there when I'm not smiling. It will still be there. A smile and a kiss and the tips of two fingers touching. She nods, and I know the nod means it is time to let go, and I do. I turn and I walk away. I make my way back to the unit. I walk in and I walk through the halls to dinner. Every meal is now the same. After dinner, there is a lecture. A man telling his life story. He was bad, and he joined AA, and now he's good. I have heard it too many times. The next day, I see Leonard walking toward me. He tells me it's time for lunch, so we walk to the dining hall and we find a table. We are joined by Ed and Ted and Maddie and Miles and Bobby. We finish lunch, and we stand and walk as a group to the lecture. We sit in the back and we play cards. For the first time since I have known him, Leonard loses every hand we play. Ted wins 3, Ed and Maddie win 2, Miles and I don't win any. When the lecture is over, everyone gives Leonard his money back. We leave. As we walk through the halls and toward the unit, Ken steps out of his office and he asks to speak with me. I step into his office and sit down and he does the same. There are a few things we need to talk about today. He picks up a piece of paper and he passes it to me. This is a release so that we can have a lawyer who works here contact the states in which you have issues and try to begin sorting them out. You need to read it, write down the states and cities and what you think the problems are, and sign it. You don't have to do it, but we highly recommend that you do. You got a pen?
Sure.
He picks up a pen and he hands it to me. I take it, start reading the document.
In a related, or somewhat related, issue, we've noticed that you've become close to Leonard. We're a bit concerned about that.
I look up.
Why?
You're a young man with a tenuous relationship with the law. We don't think that he's going to be a good influence on you.
Why's that?
Do you have any idea what Leonard does for a living?
He's a businessman of some sort.
Ken laughs.
What kind of business?
I haven't asked.
Have you ever noticed that people are scared of Leonard?
Yeah.
Why do you think that is?
Because he lives without fear. That tends to scare people.
That's not the reason, James.
What is the reason, Ken?
I'm assuming you know more than you're telling me, but I'll say it anyway. Leonard is involved in organized crime. He's a fairly major figure in that world. He has been asked not to discuss or flaunt what he does, and because he has real and serious chemical dependency issues, we did not turn him away. But we do keep a fairly close eye on him.
I shrug. Everybody's got to make a living.
That's your reaction?
That's my reaction. Next issue, Ken.